love him already. He's got the Rhode Island twang.
The long pass to Moore and a pin block from Martin.
Tune in to Cam's Corner.
He's going to make it here.
Draws the foul for another Rhode Island and one.
Podcast. He's got his own podcast.
It's good off the backboard and in.
On a break.
All right, we are back, guys. Welcome back to another episode of Camp's Corner, Season 4, Episode 12, Episode 112. Super excited to introduce today's guest, play-by-play broadcaster for the Brooklyn Nets, NBC, the Big Ten, the NFL. Just got done calling 5-on-5 men's and women's Olympic basketball. I mean, the list goes on. Noah Eagle, ladies and gentlemen. Noah, thanks so much for hopping on the podcast, man.
Cam, I appreciate it. Season 4, this is big. I feel like that's when shows really take off. So I feel real good about my spot. And I'm excited to, you know, chat with you here.
Yeah, I mean, the tier level of guests just continues to ramp up. And I like you're a part of that. Like, I'm so blessed and happy to have the people on and talk to. And it's basically for me, when I started, it was, again, basically based out of Rhode Island. I wanted to get in touch with people that, you know, made names for themselves. I wanted to get into broadcasting. And like I told you before we started, Joe Mazzulla was my first guest. So to see where it started, to see like how more comfortable I am in front of the camera, and we'll talk, of course, about reps and how that plays into play-by-play and everything you do in sports media. It's been great. So, again, happy to have you on. I mean, how do you keep up with all these different gigs? I mean, like I said, there's a plethora of things that happen for you throughout a year. So how do you keep up with all these things?
Yeah, I drink heavily. it's really all about time management, Cam. And I think the more you do it, the easier it gets in kind of how to balance everything and planning ahead and trying to work ahead so that you're not overcrowded in a 2-day span for two games or whatever it might be. And so understanding that for me, I actually have right here, I keep a physical planner. I don't do the phone or tablet or computer, just because when I can see it all directly in front of me, and I'm sure it'd be easier, but there are tendencies of mine to be a dinosaur, and I kind of like that. So I know two things. When I write it down, it's going to get in my head. And two, I can then kind of turn through the pages and really get a good glimpse of what I have ahead. Plus, when I now I'm about to start a week, I can see the entire week. And so a lot of it is just about budgeting that time and planning to make sure that I can get everything in. But it definitely gets easier with each assignment as I do it. When I first started, I think this is true for any of us, because this is a world, and you know it, this is a world that you have to be so uber prepared and over prepared on every assignment you have. I think the tendency when you first start is to prepare even more. And so I think as I've done more reps, as I've gotten more reps, as I've done more games of higher qualities, I haven't necessarily cut corners. I think I've prepared even more, but it's more efficient because I know exactly where to look. I know exactly where to find things. And then I put it down exactly where I know I'm going to look in the game. So the work becomes a little bit more efficient. And then it's just about getting it done. And there is also a point, because I think this is hard to recognize when you first start, but there's a point when you're preparing for a broadcast where you probably are done and you could keep going and you could find even more, but you don't need to anymore. It's almost better to step away. So understanding and recognizing that point is something that I think I'm still working on and still getting towards.
Yeah, and growing up in Essex Falls, New Jersey, only 20 minutes away from the Meadowlands. So I'm sure you grew up a New York Giants fan, right?
No, come on. I've got a Keyshawn Johnson Jets signed baby jersey. It's the first jersey I ever owned that's sitting up here in my office. And I was a Jets fan growing up. Cam, all the teams that provided pain from New York and suffering, those are the teams that I grew up rooting.
Oh, I know the feeling.
Yeah. So, I mean, people would ask me who I'm a fan of, and I would tell them, and they'd look at me like I was terminally ill, like something was seriously wrong with me.
Right.
Oh, my gosh, I'm so sorry. I'm like, well, no, I chose this life for myself. Right. But the phrase I always heard is it builds character. So I've got a lot of character, Cam. Tons of it.
Oh, you could tell it. Same thing to my dad. I mean, me and him, big Giants and Knicks fans coming from Rhode Island, which is kind of ironic. But now, hopefully, the Knicks can have somewhat of a, I don't want to say championship caliber season, but I mean, it's definitely on the brighter end of things from growing up, because I can name the last guy on the bench from their, whatever, 18 win season to now. So it's cool to see that. And
you were a big Lou Amundsen guy. That was the dude.
Langston Galloway, all those guys. Yeah. Random names.
You would say select. Come on.
Yeah. That's actually kind of crazy. I did see that. Yeah. But again, obviously your dad, Ian Eagle, is a longtime NBA broadcaster. I mean, right off the bat, what I always ask guests is where their passion for sports stem from. Because again, sports podcast, you know, broadcasters, athletes, coaches, you name it, whoever hops on, like, where does that stem from? So for you, obviously looking and watching in your dad's footsteps, I'm sure he had a big part in that. But if like your earliest memory, just run me through like your, where that passion for just sports in general, not even just broadcasting, but where it all kind of stemmed from.
Yeah, no, would it have been crazy if I was like, it actually was all my mom, 150%. Yeah, right. My dad had nothing to do with it. Yeah, I think that just being around it, naturally you gravitate towards it if you have a good relationship with a parent like that. And it definitely permeated in that sense. I think on top of that, to answer the second part of the question, like the earliest memories, I mentioned the Keyshawn Johnson jersey. So going to Jets games as a young kid, going to a lot of Nets games. And there were a couple that really, I think, sparked that next level. You know, I was very young when they went to back-to-back NBA finals, but I got to go to all those games. You know, my dad was working for the team. He just finished up his 30th season with the Nets organization, which is remarkable. And so my entire life and then some. I'm 27. So he's been working with them since before I was born and has gone all the way through. And so the Nets are really what sparked, I would say, my true passion for sports, and definitely that sport, NBA basketball. And there were games that really hit. I remember the first one that really sticks out was game 5, Nets Pacers. This is when the series were best of 5. Reggie Miller hits a buzzer beater to send it to overtime. Then he has a dunk to send it right before the buzzer to double overtime. And the Nets would eventually pull away, win the game, win the series, move on. In double overtime, Ron Mercer had a big period, if you will. And there was something about feeling the ground shaking in that game. Because if you're a big enough sports fan, you've probably been to an event where you can literally feel, it feels like an earthquake is around you. Mm. And that was probably the first one that I can think of that felt that way, where I go, well, this was really cool. Like everybody here, all of their backgrounds or whatever their beliefs or any of it, we all put that aside the second we stepped into this building, and we were all looking forward to the same thing, watching an awesome game, and the vast majority of the people there rooting for the same team. That it stuck with me, that hit me. And so there was something about that that was enchanting, and I really wanted to follow that feeling. I wanted to follow this united aspect that sports brings, and this escape that it has for the rest of people's lives, where for 2.5, 3, 3.5 hours, we can all just enjoy our time and each other's companies and not worry about what else is going on. We can just focus on what's in front of us. So that's the first one that really hits, but there were so many after that. And obviously the more you grow up, the more you experience both the jubilation and the pain that sports brings, the more of an intoxicating drug that it is. And so I think I fell right into it.
I'm going to jump the gun a little bit. Broadcasting in today's day, or even throughout your whole career, do you have a game in mind that takes you back to that first memory, that Pacers Nets game?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are definitely a couple, but yeah, it'd be because of the recency aspect of it, this summer doing the Olympics. Mm. I've never felt a crowd like those. So even go back to that Nets Pacers game, even go back to the game 6 between the Clippers and the Jazz, for the Clippers to get to their first ever conference finals. And it was the first game since before COVID with a full packed house, and people who worked in that building, Staples Center at the time, at least it was called, people who worked in that building for years said it was the loudest they heard that building since Kobe's last game. It was great. It was incredible in there. But the energy of the Olympics and the aspect of the globalization of the game and the fact that it was US and France for the gold medal, both men and women. Yeah, that was different. That was one where I'll never forget the feeling. I'll never forget where I was, all of that stuff. And then the other one that will always stick out is 2 years ago doing Colts at Vikings, largest comeback in NFL history. It happens to be in Minnesota, and the Vikings come back. And if you've never gone to a game in Minneapolis, a football game, and in particular a Vikings game, you don't quite understand, you can't quite grasp the aura that it provides, the skull chants when it gets going. And the cool thing about that game was, despite it being 33-0 at halftime and 36-3 in the third quarter in favor of Indianapolis, nobody left. They stayed the entire game. So it was a packed full house for when they came back and eventually won in overtime to win the division. So that those are definitely a couple that just kind of stick out right away. But I think the more that you bank and the more that you do, it always brings you back to your childhood and why you fell in love with it. And those memories always seem to flood back.
Yeah, I can't wait to dig deep into those memories, all the sports you've been able to call throughout your career. I mean, it all started at Syracuse. And again, your dad, again, played a huge role growing up, listening to him, watching him, following him throughout his journey. Obviously, that's where your passion for broadcasting started, like you mentioned. But Syracuse is where you decided to go to school. So run me through the decision process. I'm sure it was pretty easy because Syracuse, again, one of the greater schools in sports media, but and a lot of historic broadcasters have came from Syracuse. So run me through that. Talk about attending Syracuse and how those programs really pushed you to that next level.
Yeah, I would tell you the process wasn't easy for me, the decision process at least. It wasn't simple for me because my parents met there. And I think for anybody who already is planning on following in a parent's footstep, there's a level of trepidation that comes with proceeding in that and how to properly go about it and what the perception is going to look like and all of that stuff. So now double that when it's both your parents go there and you've got one who was very much involved and still is and very much is present in what they sell. And so you see his photos everywhere and his name everywhere and all of that. So there's no real escapability in it altogether. So I think I had to weigh that out. And it was the first visit I went on with my mom, spring break of my junior year of high school. We had a couple visits planned. That was just the first one we went on. And I remember leaving and 15 minutes into the car ride home, she turned to me and she goes, well, what'd you think? You know, she's so excited because she loves that school. And that's where my parents met. I mean, obviously she loves that school. And I had to break it to her in the nicest way possible. But I was like, I don't think I can go to Syracuse. And she's like, oh, really? And I'm like, yeah, I don't know if it's for me. And so we end up going, we visited a bunch of places around the country. And eventually both my parents really said, you know what, why don't we go back? Why don't you take a second look now that you've seen other places, you can compare it to something else. So go back to Syracuse and see what you think. And the second go around, my mom said, forget their tour. I'm taking you on my tour. I'm showing you the real version of Syracuse that you would actually enjoy if you're a student here. And same deal, 15 minutes on the ride home. She goes, sorry, what do you think? And I said, I have to go here. I'm applying an early decision. I got to go. And the reason was, one, she did a much better job, in my opinion, of showcasing the actual campus. But two, the facilities and the opportunities in the broadcasting sphere were so much more impressive and so much more advanced than most of the other places that I visited. Not to say that the other programs weren't great, because they really were, and they've continued to churn out some legitimate products and legitimate broadcasters across different platforms and realms. But for me, I just go, okay, this is it. I can feel the energy. We also went back on the first day of classes, so we felt that energy of first day of class, people excited, people outside. She took me on like the nicest day of the year when I didn't even think snow was possible, right? And I'm sweating as we're walking from place to place. I'm like, this is great. Who said the weather sucks here? It's crazy bad, but it's well worth it. And you all do it together. So it was the right decision for me. And then from that point on, the one thing I knew is no matter where I was going to end up, the best thing that my parents both told me is you just go and take advantage of every opportunity that's in front of you while also maintaining that you're a college student. And they were very, very understanding people, very chill people. And they wanted to make sure that I had a great overall college experience. So yes, I was going to work my ass off in the process, but you still have to go out and try to be a college kid. And so I found that right blend over time. I think the first year and a half, first three semesters or so, I really just busted my tail and I just wanted to make sure I was putting myself in good position for the rest of the time. And once I did that and I kind of proved that I was my own person, I proved that I was going to work and I was going to put in whatever was necessary to reach where I wanted to reach, then I kind of let the rest fall where it was supposed to. But it was perfect. It was everything that I wanted it to be. And I tried literally everything while I was there.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Getting into everything under the sun, every sport that you could possibly call, you know, that's kind of like the path that all these broadcasters take. I mean, you got to kind of get into everything and be versatile before you get something that really sticks. Being able to talk with so many different broadcasters and anchors, reporters, you name it. I mean, they say the same thing. They tried to do every single thing that they could to set themselves up once graduation came. But outside of those programs and outside of every game that you were able to call, of course, talk about more so about the connections that you were able to make, because that's a big thing in anything in life. But in sports media, it really goes a long way about, you know, the impressions you make on certain people. And of course, like just watching certain people in the programs grow into their own. You know what I mean? Like after you guys graduated or whatever your class was, I'm sure there were people that made paths for their own way and they're off doing their own thing. So one, just talk about, again, those connections. And two, if you've been able to keep in touch with some of the people that you met over the programs over the years.
Yeah, of course. I mean, that's a given, and that should be the case anywhere you go. And it's people within the program, people outside the program. I mean, a lot of my close friends come from Syracuse, but I think that's just how life goes. I think you pick up people and you add people within to your life and vice versa as you go from stage to stage to stage. So that goes from elementary to the middle to high school to college to your first job to your second job to your third job and so on and so forth. But yes, I've got some fantastic relationships from Syracuse and people that are in the industry that I can always rely on, and vice versa. They can always count on me. In terms of the other side of it, alumni, professors, adjuncts, employees, you know, there's a lot of others that you come in contact with over the course of 4 years. And the best example for me is how I got my first job with the Clippers was through our professor, basically, in some respects. She's in charge. Her name's Olivia Stomsky. She's in charge of the Newhouse Sports Media Center. So she's basically in charge of the sports media space within the Syracuse community, and specifically the media school, which is the SI Newhouse School of Public Communications. And she took that job, I think, before my junior year. So I really got to know her the last 2 years that I was there. And I got to know her. I got to know the voice of the Orange, Matt Park, and Brian Higgins, and many others, Scott Hecht and Kristen Hennessy, and these people that were coming in to fill these roles, some of them with the ACC Network on campus, some of them at WAER, like Cora Thomas, who is still someone near and dear to my heart. And I think you build up relationships with people like that just because they're good people. You know, you're not looking at it to say, oh, they're going to help me one day. They might. But the way I always looked at it was, all right, let me actually get to know them. Let me be there and deliver for them when they need me. And you just never know what happens from there. They're always going to be down to help you in any way. But it was never with that mentality of, I need this person to help me. It was in the mentality of, let me get to know them and let them get to know me. And I'm just going to keep taking care of what I need to take care of. You know, I'm going to keep working hard and doing that. But with Olivia, she reached out to me and a couple others, both that were current seniors. This was my senior year. Some that were recent graduates. And she said, hey, someone's interested. Can you send me your basketball reel? Just a reel of all your basketball stuff. And I was like, sure, who is it? She goes, I mean, I can't tell you. I go, what is this? Like double secret probation? Do I have a 0.0 GPA? What is this? This is, I feel like I should know. She goes, no, it's better if you don't. I go, all right, cool. So I send her the reel. She goes, send me a resume. I go, cool. And then I don't hear back for weeks, honestly, maybe for months. And I remember, I think it was the day after the national championship basketball, where I was driving to a radio show I did every Monday, and I get a call from an LA number, and I pick it up, and I said, hey. And they're like, Noah Eagle. I'm like, yeah. They go, we want to interview for the Clippers TV job. And I was like, okay, you know, one of my friends doing something. Yeah, one of my friends is pulling a joke on me. Yeah. And I was like, you sure you have the right person? He's like, yeah. We want to fly you out next week, interview you, and audition you. I was like, okay. So I flew out the following week. I interviewed, I auditioned, I took a red eye back. It went well. Steve Ballmer, the owner of the team, the following week says, I want to meet you one-on-one. I go, great. Flew out to Seattle, met with Steve one-on-one. He sat on his foot the entire interview for 90 minutes. I'm like, that thing's asleep. That thing might be dead. Forget asleep. That thing might never come back to life. But somehow he walked. He was fine. I was like, this guy's got, he's got a bionic ankle. But it was great. And it was a nice chat, and just walked in there with the mentality And this is it's a hard mentality to find, I think. But I also knew that it was the right one for me. My mentality was, if this doesn't work out, it's fine. Like, I'm about to, I haven't even graduated yet. And I'm just getting an opportunity to interview. Like, that's amazing. So let me just go and not really care and just, you know, be myself and not hold anything back and just be confident in who I am and see what happens. And so that's what I did. People always ask me, were you nervous? I'm like, no, because I didn't really expect anything. I just went in there and walked in and was just myself. And obviously ended up working out. You know, I told Steve at the end of it, if you give me the job, the Clippers will be my life. And he said, good to know. And then we parted ways. I flew back on another red eye. I graduated maybe 2 weeks later. And about a week after that, got a call saying they were going to move their radio guy up to TV and that they wanted me to take the radio job. And the rest was history. But none of that would have happened without Professor Stomsky, who got a call from people that she was either mutuals, or they were former coworkers, but people she was friends with in the industry that were helping to run the search for the Clippers. And so it just goes back to us having a good relationship. And that's really what Syracuse is all about. And that's what really any school is all about, is making sure that you are doing your due diligence, but also just being a real person and getting to know these people and letting the rest kind of fall the way it's supposed to.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, my goal is for sure going to be the NBA. It is the NBA, and I know it'll happen in due time. But I mean, one of my favorite questions to ask, like I said, athletes, coaches, whoever, especially if they work in the NBA, because I'm a big basketball fan at heart. That's like my favorite sport to watch. Grew up on it, and like your welcome to the NBA moment, your first time on air, or even like a different time on air where you were like, all right, this is the NBA. This isn't Syracuse. I mean, Syracuse is great, but this is like the big leagues. Like, I'm here calling professional basketball.
Yeah. I mean, my timing was impeccable getting to the Clippers, because I got there in the summer of 2019, which was the summer that they acquired Kawhi Leonard and Paul George. So The feeling going into the season was they were the title favorite. If you go back to it, they had just come off a 48 win season. They had taken Golden State to 6 games without a real superstar on the team. Now, they did have a rookie, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, but nobody at the time thought he was going to be a guy who was averaging 30 points per game. They thought he was going to be an all-star. And you ask anybody in the Clippers, you know, even before I got there, they were telling people this kid's going to be an all-star. So they were trying to do everything they could to keep him. But unfortunately for them, they obviously could not. And they to lure Kawhi, you know, everybody says the Paul George trade was insane. Kawhi Leonard wasn't going to come unless they got Paul George. Pretty simple. And so they had to do it. I get it. All that to say, they were a 48-win team. They retained the majority of that nucleus with Patrick Beverley, with Lou Williams, with Montrezl Harrell, and Landry Shamet was coming off a huge rookie year. Like, there was this level of excitement that they believed that they were the title favorites adding those two guys. And everybody, I think, agreed and concurred. And then you had the Lakers, who acquired Anthony Davis that same summer. And now you've got LeBron and AD. And so it was this incredible energy of basketball in Los Angeles. And for the first time, it felt like the Clippers and the Lakers were good at the same time. And finally, they can battle it out. Because when Lob City was going on, the Lakers were brutal. And before that, obviously, the Clippers were brutal. And so they never matched up. So it was already just an electric feel. And then the first assignment I had was to go to training camp with the team and do preseason in Hawaii, which they told me, and I go, yeah, that's not going to work for me. Yeah, I'm going to pass on that. No, I was thrilled. I'm like, oh yeah, let's go. Free trip to Hawaii. Come on, man. I was already cool enough to just do the games. I would have done them from a dungeon. Are you serious?
Yeah, I'm all set. No.
That's crazy. Yeah. Sorry guys. I'm good. I'm going to pass on that. No, it was great. So the first game I called was against the Rockets, and the difference, I would say, already was apparent. Now, this was the extreme, but I'm pretty sure that there were more free throws in that game than any game I've ever called. And I was doing, for the first time ever, the radio broadcast by myself. I had no analyst for all 4 years that I was with the Clippers, but this was the first time that I was ever doing it. And when you have a ton of free throws, that means you have a ton of airtime that you have to fill and figure out how to be entertaining and engaging and all of that. So that was the first kind of, okay, this is going to be a little different. But that opening day of the regular season, and I think it was October 22nd, 2019, it was either the 20th or the 22nd, and it was Clippers-Lakers. It was Kawhi's first ever game in a Clipper uniform. PG was still recovering from shoulder surgery. And it was an absolute battle of a game. And the Clippers end up winning the game. Kawhi had 30 or 31 and outdueled LeBron in the game. And then we went from there to Golden State to face off against a Warriors team that at that time was coming off this dynasty. Now they had lost Kevin Durant, who was out anyway with the Achilles, but they still, and they didn't have Klay because he was out with the ACL, but they still had Steph and Draymond, and they had D'Angelo Russell at the time. And it was their first game at the brand new Chase Center. So this is brand new. Obviously it's massive for everybody. And the Clippers absolutely spanked them in that game. I mean, Patrick, that's the famous video with Patrick Beverly going, "Hey, wait, where y'all going? Where y'all going?"
Yeah.
That was my first ever real road game in the NBA. And so for those to be the first two games, I go, "Oh, this is amazing." And then slowly but surely over 4 years, you definitely learn, and now five plus heading with the Nets, but you definitely learn that it's not always like that. And even that season, like the crazy thing about that season, you know, Doc Rivers was the head coach. So think about the stature of the head coach that I have right off the bat that I'm interviewing before every game and just trying to learn how to deal with something like that. And he was always great with me, but you have something like that. Then you've got superstars on the team. Like that's not a normal NBA experience. And so for me, every game was important. Every game felt like life or death. And that was the vibe around the team. That was a vibe around the fan base, where if they lost a game, even if it was to a really good team, say they lost to Milwaukee or they lost to the Lakers, it was like the sky was falling every time. And so it was so different than, you know, Syracuse. There's that level of, hey, they care a lot about Syracuse basketball. That is a massive deal. But it wasn't quite to this level of, we know that there's a chance that this team can win a championship this year if everything goes the right way. And then obviously COVID hits. And so that was very different. But the overall first year, I mean, I was having such a blast just going. These were all new experiences for me. It was awesome. And I really wish, obviously, COVID never happened, because I do think the Clippers would have had a little bit of a different story if it didn't, because they were playing some excellent basketball. At least I think they get a matchup with the Lakers in the conference finals, and then we have just an all-out battle, because those teams were very evenly matched that year. But you can't change history, and so it was different. I had to adjust on the fly and do games remotely, which was another kind of test for me. And honestly, it was great training. It put me in a mindset that I can do whatever I have to do, and any assignment that I get offered, I'll be ready to go.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you down the line, but again, just jumping into these Clippers experiences the first few years out of school and everything, like for me personally, like I don't know about you, but when I was, before I got into like the broadcasting scene, anytime I would see like a professional athlete or like someone I looked up, I would be like so starstruck. Like that was sure. That's just me as a person. I was always so starstruck. That was like so my senior year, Ray Allen's son played for URI, so I had the pleasure of calling some of his games. I called his first ever bucket, and Ray was at the game, and I got to meet him. I got to meet who else was at some of those games? Quinn Cook was at a game for his cousin that used to play at URI. Jimmy Butler and Kyle Lowry were at a game with their old assistant for the Heat, Anthony Carter, because his son Devin Carter played for PC.
Yeah.
So like I'm in the midst of all these guys, and this is only in Rhode Island. I can only imagine what it would have been like at Syracuse, of course, being in the NBA. But like those first few years on the job with the Clippers, did you ever have like a starstruck moment, like first getting there, like, damn, like Kawhi Leonard, Paul, like they're right. This is the real deal.
No, I think part of that is being around my dad for my whole life. You know, he's around these stature, that level of stature person constantly. Mm. And so I was the same way, where I would see these people and it was just another person. Now I do feel like that was also just my personality in some ways, where I never viewed it that way. It's rare for me to get starstruck. I can't recall many times. The only time that I got close, and I still feel like I was very much maintaining composure or whatever, would be Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. I interviewed him actually before I started with the Clippers. So the 2 years prior, I actually did the Junior NBA Global Championship. I was a sideline reporter for Fox. And the second year they go, "Hey, you're going to interview Kareem." And they would mess with me all the time. I was the young guy, so they would mess with me. But that one, I thought I would have gotten starstruck by who I was working with, because I grew up and Vince Carter was my favorite player of all time. He was a Net, obviously in the kind of formative years of my life. And so for me, he was, that was everything. And I was working with him now. And every day I was hanging out with him and I wasn't really getting starstruck over him. And so I felt like, okay, if I'm not going to get starstruck over Vince, I'm not going to get starstruck over anybody. And then they go, hey, you're going to interview Kareem. And I thought they were messing with me. I'm like, ah, yeah, good one. And they're like, no, seriously, you got to go over to him and say, hey, who you are and say you're going to interview him. I'm like, what? And so I go over and Kareem is sitting courtside next to his daughter. And I'm like, where am I supposed to go? So I go up and I say, hey, Mr. Abdul-Jabbar, Noah Eagle, I'm here with Fox. They said that you'd be okay to get interviewed. He goes, oh, yeah, oh, yeah, that's okay. I go, great. And then he looks at his daughter. He goes, you're going to have to get up. And so I had to take his daughter's seat. And I was like, I'm so sorry. She's like, no, no, it's totally fine. I was like, I'll come get you. Like, it won't be fat. It won't be long. It'll be very quick. She goes, no, take your time. So he was good. He was gracious and everything. And then we moved on from there. But yeah, that would be the closest I got. Well, really around the players. No, they were, to me, I think that part of the requirement of this job is almost seeing yourself on everybody else's level. Now, you don't have to be cocky, but you've got to have a quiet confidence of, you know what, we're the same. We're traveling the same way. We're staying in the same place because that's what you do when you go with the team and work for a team. So I think the sooner you see that, the easier the job becomes because they're not immortal anymore. Now everybody's on an even playing field. And I do think that's important just in being a good broadcaster overall.
Yeah, and again, like we talked about how you've maneuvered around basketball, football. I saw you were an MLB studio host at one point. So like there's just a bunch of different sports, like again, at, like post-college. Because of course in college, like you want to do as much as possible, but still graduating and doing all these things. Like how do you maneuver from sport to sport? How do all these different opportunities come? And how do you apply yourself for these opportunities with, you know, these major leagues and stuff like that?
Yeah, so I think the thing that I always try to remind, and this is true with any field, the thing to remind yourself is the hardest job to get is the first one. The hardest big break to get is that first big break. Because to me, once you get that first big one, and this is what I've seen, the rest can fall. It's like the first domino that then knocks the rest of them over. And that's been the case for me. I got the Clipper job, and now it was I wasn't as much of a risk anymore. And then even if it was a slight risk to get the next step up, whatever that might be with a network or something, you know, I did the Nickelodeon game. That was it was risky for them to put me on that. I was, I think, 23 or 24. And so I was young and they took that risk and it went well. So now the next person is a little bit more willing to take the risk because now I'm not an unknown commodity. And with each thing that I did, I was even more known of a commodity. So the rest just kind of happened. And then eventually it led to me getting hired by NBC and now you know, I work with them and so they can put me on whatever they want. So that included, you mentioned it off the top, Big Ten was really what I initially got hired for. So I was doing the Big Ten football game of the week and the Big Ten basketball game of the week that they had. And then they had a couple extra NFL games. They said, hey, let's put them on the NFL. And then they had the French Open this year. They said, let's put them on the French Open. And then the Olympics, I go, let's put them on the Olympics. And so now I'm within the family. They can do whatever they want and they can ask me to do whatever they want and I'll be here for them. You know, I'm here to deliver. So a lot of it just comes down to when you do get that big first thing, just do good work and be a good person and keep building friendships more than networking, which is the word I hate because I just think it has that negative connotation to it. I think if you just build real, genuine relationships with people, and you do really good work, then the rest always finds it for you. It's that energy that attracts you.
So you got that Clippers job in 2019, correct? After graduating?
Yes.
And from that point, obviously, again, we said all the plethora of sports, but how do you keep a tape fresh when you're only focusing on one thing? So from 2019, I think to like 2021, maybe it was just all strictly Clippers, right?
Somewhat, you know, I was doing Tennis Channel. I've worked with Tennis Channel since 2019. They're out in LA. And so it was almost too easy. They offered me a job before the Clippers ever did. So they were the first people to offer me a job. And I didn't think I was going to actually get to do it because I figured I was just going to be moving to New York and I was going to be trying to find work out here. And obviously the Clippers come calling, and now I'm moving to LA, and it completely changes the outlook for the tennis world. And so I get to do both. But yeah, I think the best thing that I remember from college is a lot of kids were so focused before going into a game saying, I need to get a good stretch for my tape. And it's the worst thing you can do going into a game. The way that I always view it, and always did, and this was something my dad really hammered into my head, was don't worry about the tape. Worry about doing good work, and the tape takes care of itself. And so even if to answer your question, to say, hey, how do you keep it fresh? No, it's not even keeping it fresh. It's how do I just keep getting better every single time I'm on the air? And so even if you're doing one thing, how are you improving? Even if it's 1%, you know, the second that you're done improving is the second you're done altogether. Nobody's a finished product. I don't care how many games you've banked. I don't care how many years you've been doing this. I don't care what level of event you're doing. You can get better. I mean, that's how all the athletes we cover think about it. That's how Kobe Bryant's mentality was, Michael Jordan, LeBron James. These guys who are at the top of their field, they always find at least one little thing that they can work on in the offseason, or one little thing that they're working on in practice, or one thing they want to work on over the course of the season. Why can't we do the same exact thing? And so I don't really look at it as, hey, we've got to freshen up this tape. I look at it as, how can I continue to sharpen my skills?
Yeah, so it wasn't more so about, like, again, not having called football since college. It was more so just, like, the quality of whatever sport you were calling. That's kind of how you got those. Yeah, so correct. I figured, like, my mindset was always, like, they want to see you kind of doing every sport. But now that you say that, it kind of makes it a little bit easier to understand how, like, these types of things came your way, because like your dad said, great advice, not only just focusing on, like, a stretch of a game, but just the game itself in general will have you know, the tape kind of come to itself, which is pretty cool to hear. And like you mentioned, the Nickelodeon game came about. I was gonna say, that was for the Super Bowl last year, right?
So we've done five of them now, but yes, we did the Super Bowl last year. That,
that was your first one. Was that your first one?
No, I've done all five.
Okay, yeah. So yeah, not with Chris Collinsworth, but with SpongeBob and Patrick, right?
Yeah. So I mean, it's been an interesting evolution for that game. The first one we did was January of 2021, and so that was me, Nate Burleson, Gabby Nevaeh-Green, and Lex Lumpkin. The four of us kind of launched this thing. The next year, we had young Dylan to the fold. We did Cowboys and 49ers, the game that Dak slid down and ran out of time. So we went to AT&T Stadium for that. The following year, we did a Christmas game in LA. It was Rams hosting the Broncos, where Patrick roasted Russell Wilson. And after Patrick roasted Russell Wilson and it went viral, because he said, that's not what he wanted to cook.
Yeah.
You know, once he gave him that and everybody loved it, I think the NFL and Nickelodeon and Paramount all were like, we need to do this at the highest level. And then they had the Super Bowl that year. And so we did two games last year. One was a Christmas game again, Chiefs Raiders. And that one was with a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle, Nate and myself. And then we did the Super Bowl, where it was me, Nate, SpongeBob, Patrick, young Dylan, and Dylan Schefter all doing the game. And we had Adam Schefter sitting with us in the booth as we're calling the game on his phone, furiously texting people and taking calls. And I'm like, dude, I'm trying to call a game in Bikini Bottom, and you want to figure out if Drake Greenlaw's torn his Achilles. There's a lot going on right here, but one of the cooler experiences for sure. And I definitely never thought that I would call a game with my good friends now from Bikini Bottom. Well, it wasn't even just SpongeBob and Patrick. I should say Larry the Lobster was there. Sandy Cheeks was there. So we had a full squad, and it was an absolute blast. So another one of those that I'll never forget for sure. And obviously an incredible game.
I remember seeing that for the first time, that they launched the Nickelodeon broadcasts. And for my friends that watch the pod and that, of course, have known me for my, like, entire life, like, they know that I love doing, like, the stupid little, like, voice impressions. I've always wanted to be, like, a voice actor, like, for, like,
well,
a
give
cartooner.
Me what you got, man. I gotta hear
Dude,
it
that's
now.
The thing. That's the thing. I haven't unleashed one on the podcast yet, and I don't know if I'm ready for it, but but that's the thing. You gotta break out of your shell to show the people what you got.
Well, listen,
but,
Cam, to get that job, the crazy thing is, to get that job, when I interviewed for it the first year, they said, the woman, Paula, who was interviewing me, said, look, it's not a requirement. I thought they were just talking to me. I thought I was the only, but I found out later, like years later, that I was one of three, and they were fine with all three going in. They're like, hey, whatever, whichever one we get the best vibe from. And I was the only one, apparently, when they asked if you watch Nickelodeon, that not only said yes, I was the only one that said yes, but not only said yes, but then broke into all impressions, whether it was Patrick, I did Drake and Josh. I told this whole story about
that's literally sister. Me. That's, oh my God.
Yeah, crazy. I said this whole story about how my sister's number one regret was never getting to meet Josh Peck because she had multiple opportunities to do it. And I just gave a hug, brother, you know, and they're like, we got to have this guy. He's got to do it. This is perfect. And so that's how I got it for sure.
Yeah, you just got to do it. I know. Like, I've never did it on. Well, so funny backstory for my intro for the podcast. The last clip is a clip of me in high school shooting a corner three. Right. And the name Cam's Corner came from my good friends back at home, Nick nice. And Tom. Camella, and one day I was trying to figure out a name. I had the idea of the pod. I couldn't think of like a name for it, and they were like, what about Cam's Corner? Like, you were always good at shooting threes in the corner. And there was an episode of Family Guy where Peter Griffin is doing the corner three, like lag, and like he's just shooting corner threes, going corner three, like that's like that was the thing, like that was like that should be your thing, that should be like your shtick. And like obviously like that kind of just stuck. Like I have that soundbite in that intro for since 2021, so trying to bring a little bit of personality for sure to like to this and to the broadcast. I mean, like when I saw the voice of I always forget his name, but the voice of Patrick calling
Bill Fagerbakke.
I would love to, oh my God, meet like that. That's like my dream, to call sports and to be a cartoon character. That is amazing.
Yeah, it was pretty awesome. The question is, are you going to now incorporate a little bit of Cleveland's? That's not fair.
And see, I can't do that.
No corners.
You know. I love doing Joe. He's like, they did Bo Jackson. There was a football one too. Switch your guy, Quagmire. Switch your guy, and like he's Bo Jackson just running around the field. Oh my God, yeah, like that's the best. That's amazing. I love that. But I mean, no, I could keep you here all day talking about everything that you've gone through. But I did want to cap off, of course, with the most recent thing with the Olympics. Being able to call games alongside Dwayne Wade in Paris. I mean, it's like a once in a lifetime opportunity. And like you said, those crowds are like, probably the biggest crowds, the most electrifying crowds you've been in. But, correct me if I'm wrong, in 2020, I want to say one or 22, you called 3-on-3 men's and women's basketball too, correct?
21. Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah. So that was your first Olympic experience, but how does that differ from the first time to now? And like, just talk about how you got that experience and opportunity.
Yeah, major difference. I think the first and the most obvious one is 2021 was COVID. So one, there were no fans there. Mm-hmm. And two, I didn't get to go. I was doing it in Connecticut. I was doing it all remote. So now transfer over to 2024, I'm in Paris, although the first week we were in Lille, which actually ended up being an exceptional environment. It was probably about twice the amount of fans were allowed in there. I think they had 30,000 fans in the first week and somewhere around 16,000 in the second week. It was somewhere like that, but it was incredibly loud. They were incredibly engaged. People were willing to travel extra length to get to these games. And I'll never forget the first day. So Dwayne had never really called a game before, ever. And I think the closest thing he had to calling a game, he did the Rising Stars Challenge a couple years ago. That's not real analyst work or play-by-play work. That's, you know, messing around, having fun, just joking around, which I think is important. It's something that Dwayne and I did a lot of, but we also got down to the nitty-gritty when it was time for it. But day one, we had two games that day. We had doubleheader. First game was France against Brazil, which is, you're saying, all right, let's see how this all goes. But it's a French crowd for a French team that has dreams and beliefs that they are going to win a gold medal and or at least compete for one. And the first player out an hour before tip-off, it's a full hour before tip-off. At an NBA game, the arena is maybe 10% full, maybe 15. If it's Steph Curry, you could say they're 25%. This place was 95% full an hour before tip-off. And the first person to run out of the locker room area is Victor Wembanyama. He gets a major applause. He just basically sucks a ball up with his left hand off the ground, jogs up to midcourt, flings a half-court shot, nothing but net.
With one hand?
That's the loudest, literally, perfect, went in.
Oh, my God.
First shot an hour before, literally like the most casual thing you've ever seen. And Dwayne hadn't seen him in person yet. And he goes, what the hell was that? I go, oh, just wait. Just wait, brother. Just wait. And the crowd was crazy. And I would say every game of a French team we did, because you mentioned I did men and women. And this was true, I think, across all sports there. But definitely just from my experience in the basketball. I try every now and then to really, because a lot of times once you get into the broadcast, you're so entrenched in it that you're not even really aware of what's happening around you. You're just so engrossed in what's in front of you. And so I do try to at least take a moment to appreciate the surrounding. And it was made easy when I did these French games, because the French team would come out, they would warm up, everything, it would be crazy already. And then they'd line up for the national anthem. And they didn't have a singer. They would just play the instrumental of the national anthem. And every single person in there was belting it. Absolutely belting it. And by the way, it was putting ours to shame. When it was U.S. and France, like the U.S., you could hear a pin drop, basically. France, it was insane. Insanely loud. Understandably so. And so then that provides you so much energy going to a game. I know I saw someone sent me a tweet that someone tweeted out, I think, during the men's gold medal game. The first couple minutes, the first 2 minutes of that game, one, it was so loud in there and it was so energizing in there that it's impossible not to fall into that and not to get caught up in that to a certain degree. But two, it was this fast paced. Both teams were scoring. Both teams were starting out fast and physical, whatever. So you hear it sounds like I'm in the fourth quarter of a game. We're just starting. And I think someone sent me a tweet. It was like, please tell No Eagle not to lose his voice by the second quarter. And I'm like, I know, I'm trying my best over here. Tough, but this energy is unreal. No, it's unreal. And so yeah, those were really, really special. Those rank, it's gonna be hard, you know, after the last 4 days, because in the last 4 days we had US come back against Serbia in the semifinals. Mm. And shock everybody to win that game. We had the men beat France in the gold medal game. And then we had the women literally by inches beat the French women's team in their gold medal game, all within a 4 day span. And so after those days were done, I talked to my dad on the phone and he said the same thing he said to me after the Vikings Colts game. That was the comeback that I was talking about earlier. He said, you could call basketball for 40 more years after this and you'll never get three games like that ever again. He goes, so hope you enjoyed them. I'm like, yeah, thanks, Dad. Appreciate it. Really gives me solace for the future. But he's right. And not to say I'm not going to do some more incredible games. I think I will for the rest of my career. And that's the hope. That's what we all want. But those games were with the stakes, with everything going into them, with the environment, with the celebrities, with just all of the factors that went into it, and the guys who were on the court in particular, the fact that LeBron, Steph, and KD are playing together, the fact that it was Diana Taurasi's final Olympics, and all of these other things that kind of came together. Yeah, it's going to be hard to top those. So I'm still basking in it all these months later after the fact, and I don't think that's going to go away for a while.
Yeah, and I know you said like you've never really had like a starstruck type of moment, because again, growing up with your dad and being around that, kind of like groomed you for the future. But to be able to sit courtside with a Hall of Famer, to watch future Hall of Famers, I mean, like you just mentioned, LeBron, KD, and Steph on the floor for a whole stretch in the Olympics. I mean, that's pretty surreal to be able to be a part of. I mean, did that ever hit you? This is incredible. This is my job and I get to be a part of all this.
Well, that all the time. I think after the fact, you always have a reflection of, okay, that was pretty sweet.
Yeah.
You know, this is pretty cool. But Dwayne is such a normal guy when you're around him that you don't even, I guess it would hit where we would walk out, you know, like I remember there was one day, I think we went to dinner after and we're walking on the street and like Derek White is just walking along on the other side and nobody is going up to him or anything. Nobody is flooding him for pictures. And Dwayne takes one step outside and it's like a full group of people are there. People were lining up in our hotel lobby waiting for him for photos, for autographs, for him to sign a jersey that they literally bought that morning. you know, they were, it was crazy. So that part of it kind of gave you the perspective. But no, when I was doing it with him, it was really, I was more so focused on making him as comfortable as possible because he had never done it. And he didn't need my help all that much. He was real good, real quick. So yeah, we just had a good time. The way we looked at it and the way I hope every broadcaster looks at it is it's us just hanging out, watching ball and talking about it. And hopefully most of the people that watch felt that because that was what we were going for.
Yeah. And being so sharp on air, I mean, and for me to look up to people like yourself and all the broadcasters and anchors, reporters that I've been able to have on, I look at myself like I'm very, very particular in how I do stuff. And I'm like, oh, I could have did that better. But if I send it to somebody or, you know, somebody to look at it, they're like, oh, that wasn't too bad. But here's like constructive criticism. Right. But I'm very, very hard on myself as a professional. We talked about your entire career as a whole. Your most like royal mess up. Can you bring me back to the first time? Like you like completely messed something up on the air. If it did happen, but just run me through that. And then like just coming to the present day on how much you've grown since that point.
Yeah. I mean, I remember that pretty well. My first year with the Clippers, it was, you know, I think that first year in the NBA and my replacement with the Clippers, Carlo Jimenez, who's an outstanding broadcaster and has built a great brand for himself and is awesome. He's an awesome guy, awesome person. He's only going to keep getting better. But we were talking towards the end of the season and he reached out and said that he felt what I'm about to describe, which is when you go from college, this is one of the main differences as well. Even let's say you do all the games, and Carlo did almost every game at USC. I didn't because there were so many people at Syracuse, you want to divvy up and make sure you're sharing. But even if you do every game, there's about 30, 35 in a college season. There's 82 in an NBA season, plus preseason, plus postseason. So the wear and tear of, because in a college season, you have two games per week usually, Tuesday, Saturday, let's say. And that's what you got. And so you've got all that ample time in between to prepare. In a NBA season, you've got 3, 4, maybe even 5 games in a week. There were times with the Clippers where they'd have 4 games in 5 days. They'd have back-to-back, one day off, back-to-back. So you've got to do that. You've got to bring up the energy. You've got to prepare ahead of time. You've got to do all the stuff that's required of you. And you've got to sustain that for 82 games plus the pre and postseason. And so my first year, I think that did hit right before All-Star break because at that point we'd gone nonstop essentially from when I left for training camp October 1st all the way until third week of February. And so this was literally, and when I say the last game, I mean the last game in the NBA before All-Star break. It was Clippers at Celtics. And it was an awesome, awesome game. Honestly, every Clipper Celtics game that I did that year, and honestly, my whole 4 years, they were pretty much all outstanding games. And that one in particular, I'm pretty sure went to overtime because we thought the Clippers were going to win. It might have gone to double overtime, actually. We thought the Clippers were going to win on a Lou Williams 4-point play. They didn't. I think they called it 3. There was something about it there. They did not call a foul. Like it was something crazy. But I do remember my biggest mess up in that game. Marcus Morris had joined the team at the trade deadline. It was a big acquisition at the time. He was averaging a career high in New York, where he's now back playing for the Knicks this year. He was having a career season and shooting 46% from 3. So it felt like it was the guy who was going to essentially be the missing piece for the Clippers. And he's in the game late, former Celtic as well. And he kicks it out, gets a rebound. Somehow he ends up with a ball to tie the game late in regulation to essentially send it to overtime. And I think I was discombobulated, the wear and tear of the season. The seat for radio in Boston was my first time ever sitting there. It's behind the basket in the corner, so you're getting blocked from seeing a portion of the court. So I think I was just out of my element, and I called him Marcus Smart. And now I'm doing radio. Marcus Smart plays for the wrong team, and if he made a basket, the game's over. And I'm, you know, losing my mind over it. And then I realize it. Now I try to backtrack, and I felt terrible about it because it's a huge shot in the waning seconds. And when they play back the highlights of the game, you have to include that. And so I just knew it in the moment. And so we end up going through. The Clippers end up losing that game in double overtime, I'm pretty sure it was. And the best thing that you can do as a broadcaster is you just flush it and move. But it did give me this great lesson of, hey, no matter how tired you are, no matter what's going on outside, no matter how many games you've done in the week, no one at home cares. You know, nobody, they just want the information. They want to make sure that just you're giving what they need, what they require all the time. And so it was a good reminder that even when you're exhausted, you've got to be on your P's and Q's. You've got to be focused, locked in. And I don't think I ever did that again. I can promise you that much. You know, you might every now and then say the wrong name, but it's not in a big moment. The big moments, I know you've got to be hyper-focused. And I think ever since then, I have been.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty surreal to get you to talk about all these different experiences in such a little time, all these things that have happened in your career. It's pretty amazing. And I know I caught you in the midst of football season. I know you're a very busy guy. So like I said, I appreciate you so much, Noah, for hopping on. I want to close off the podcast with, if you could tell your younger self something that you know now, a piece of advice, what would you tell him?
So the best piece of advice I remember that first year with the Clippers I got was from Rip Hamilton. I was doing All-Star Weekend stuff with him that year, and his kids were there. And his kids were, they were fearless. Anybody they saw that they wanted a photo with or they wanted an autograph, they went right up to them. They didn't care who it was. Giannis? Yeah, of course. Jokic? Yeah, no problem. So I was like, man, your kids are not bashful, huh? And he goes, yeah, I tell them every day, closed mouths don't get fed. And I was like, what? He goes, closed mouths don't get fed. And no one had put it like that to me before. I was always, by nature, still am a fairly shy person. And I was never an advocate for myself when I was younger. And so it gave me this mentality or this at least perspective of, hey, no one's going to do it for you. If you want something, a lot of times you've got to go and fight for yourself. If something isn't going the way you need it to go, or someone isn't treating you the way you need to be treated, sometimes it's okay to speak up, because you're not going to be fed. You're going to stay hungry if your mouth is closed. So that's probably what I would tell my younger self, is just be a little bit more bold every now and then. You don't have to be in your face. You don't have to be annoying about it, but understand the moments where it's okay to, you know, at least speak for yourself.
I talked with NBA vet CJ Miles a month ago. Not only did he say his welcome to the NBA moment was against Rip, but he said the exact same thing that you just said. So
yeah, man,
that is amazing. Great way to end off the pod again. Episode 112, season 4, episode 12, No Eagle. Thank you again so much for hopping on. We'll see you guys in the next episode of Camp's Corner.